that contained an electrical outlet. That way, picture lights could be affixed to the frame without a length of unsightly electrical wire hanging down to the baseboards. In my Aunt Jin's trailer when I was growing up, she'd sometimes have power strips hosting double and triple adapters with 8 brown cords trailing from a single socket, like piglets nursing at a sow. I thought all sockets looked like that. The two women studied the room, and the woman in the power suit said, "That's all going to have to come out." "What do you suggest?" "Quick fix? Get all that fabric out of there and paint the walls charcoal gray. That'll hide some of the flaws." The woman in black velour looked at me sharply. "Who's this?" The woman who'd answered the door said, "She has a meeting with Mr. Xenakis. I was going to show her to the gym." The woman looked annoyed, but resumed her conversation without further reference to me. That one had to be the wife. I followed my fearless leader through an enormous kitchen where a young woman in a white double-breasted chef's jacket and striped pants stood at the white granite counter chopping onions. A middle-aged man in a tuxedo vest and a dazzling white shirt sat at the kitchen table, polishing silver sconces. Through a doorway I could see the laundry room. A Hispanic woman in a white uniform looked up at me as she took a damp white linen napkin from a clothes basket. She gave the seams a sharp snap, laid the napkin on the ironing board, and took up her iron. When we arrived at the French doors along the back wall, my companion opened one and pointed. Outside, an ocean of lush grass covered the shallow hill to the swimming pool. The gym was apparently located in the pool house, a structure identical to the main house, only in miniature. I said, "Thanks." I took a stone path down the hill, past the koi pond, past an orchard of plum and apricot trees. Sprinklers came to life and shot out fans of water that created a rainbow against the cloudless sky. Had anybody heard about the drought in this part of town? At the pool house below, I could see Ari Xenakis in the doorway in shorts, a tank top, tennis socks, and running shoes. I put him in his mid-50s, short and barrel-chested, but otherwise trim. A lacy bib of dark chest hair spread out under his tank top. He had a pug nose, bright brown eyes, and a nice smile that showed faintly crooked teeth. "I spend half my life down here. House is like a zoo these days. This is the only place I get any peace and quiet," he said. "Come on in."
"Are you moving?"
"We've leased out the house for a year, so we're clearing storage space. That's what the mess in the hall is about. A lot of that stuff I'm donating to a charity auction." I followed him to the gym and watched as he returned to his treadmill, which he'd put on pause. Over his shoulder, he said, "You can forget antiques, anything with a pedigree. Stella's big on contemporary everything. Houses, furniture, modern art. Actually, she doesn't much like art of any kind." The home gym was square and had to be 30 feet on a side. The walls were mirrored, and the interior was crowded with free weights and universal machines, 2 treadmills, an elliptical trainer, a stationary bike, and a recumbent bike, all of it doubled and tripled in reflection. Ari mopped his face on a white terry cloth bar towel he'd hung around his neck and set the treadmill in motion with a push of a button. The start was slow, but picked up rapidly until he was pounding in place. He cranked up the incline and increased the speed. He was already sweating heavily, but he wasn't out of breath. His shoulders and arms had a rosy cast from exertion. I watched the belt's relentless forward motion, the seam coming around again and again. Our conversation unfolded against the mechanical grinding of the treadmill and the soul-slapping of his running shoes. "Thanks for coming, by the way," he said. "Detective Nash says you're a busy lady, so I appreciate your taking the time to drive out. You meet the bride?" "Not formally." He shook his head once. Might have made a mistake on that one. Jury's still out. It wasn't clear whether he was referring to his wife or the interior designer, but I could have sworn it was the wife. I understand you're about to leave on your honeymoon. No worry on that score. I wouldn't file until we got back. She might turn out to be a keeper and think of all the dough I'd save. Did Nash tell you the story? He didn't. He shook his head. You'll hear it sooner or later, so you might as well hear it from me. I have no complaints coming because I got what I deserved. Stella's husband dropped dead on the job. He was the architect on the condominium remodel I was doing at the time. Talented guy, 48 years old. Heart attack. Boom. The four of us knew each other socially, so he dies, Stella's at loose ends, and I stepped into the breach. Teddy was in L.A., so I had dinner with Stella one night at the club, just being nice. And one thing led to another. Didn't mean anything to me, but right away I realized my mistake. Teddy's down at some seminar, and I didn't see how she could possibly find out. She gets home, and some pal of hers calls and rats me out. She filed for divorce the same week. She doesn't waste any time, does she? Knocked me for a loop. I wasn't serious about Stella until Teddy booted me out. And then, what choice did I have? When we hashed out the settlement, Teddy got the condominium where the poor guy died. How's that for irony? Not good. Everything's gone downhill since then. Naturally, Teddy didn't want the place, so she decided to sell. 4,600 square feet, and the real estate agent told her it was worth $1 million or more because of the location. Where is it? Downtown Santa Teresa. The penthouse suite in a brand new office building. 18 months it sat. Teddy was living in Bel Air by then, and she got the bright idea we should get the place spiffed up, have a brochure printed, and promote the listing with real estate agents in Beverly Hills. Sure enough, a hotshot actor came along and paid full freight. This was a month ago. 10-day escrow, all cash, and no contingencies. Close of sale, I knew she'd whip in there and take everything that wasn't nailed down, so I emptied the place before she could. She ended with $1 million in cash. You know what I got? Only the stuff I managed to sneak out from under her nose. Real estate goes in her column, used furniture in mine. He waited for my reaction, hoping for sympathy, which he clearly felt was warranted. I made a non-committal mouth noise. These were not problems I could readily relate to. Chapter 33. I tried another subject, thinking a change in category might lighten the mood. Do you and Teddy have children? Not her. I have three with my first wife. The kids adored Teddy, but don't have much use for this new one. They can't believe I messed up. They're barely speaking to me. Anyway, enough of that. I thought he meant he'd talked enough about Teddy and we were moving on to something else. But he said, "How did you meet her?" "Who?" "Teddy." I asked Nash, and he said you'd tell me. "She called my office and said she needed help with a personal matter. The address she gave was the Clipper Estate, so that's where we met." I told him about Hallie Betancourt and her sob story about the baby she gave up for adoption. I assumed it was all true. She said her father was an architect who tore down the original mansion and designed the contemporary residence that's up there now. Sounded right to me, and the setup was so elaborate. It never dawned on me the scene was arranged for my benefit. "Teddy, in a nutshell, why'd she pick you?" "She said she wanted to hire a woman because she thought she'd find a sympathetic ear." This was one of the few things she said that still rings true in retrospect. She also said she needed a go-between so she could keep her name out of it. I think that was true as well. I could see the charade didn't make any more sense to him than it had to me. I went on to describe how I acquired the contact information on Christian Satterfield, which I sent her in my report. That having found out the bills she paid me were marked, I then went back to the property, hoping to pick up a lead to her whereabouts, but the place was clean except for a paperclip I found on the deck. That was the end of it, as far as I was concerned. They must have been keeping an eye on him because he was spotted in a dive called Lou's, having a long, intense conversation with a woman Nash thought might be Hallie Betancourt. He called the next day to tell me Satterfield was parked outside the shores in a limousine. On the off chance he was waiting for the mysterious Ms. Betancourt, he suggested I check it out. Instead of Hallie, the woman who showed up was Kim Bass. The limousine took off for Los Angeles, and I followed. Kim is Teddy's friend from way back. I hear she and Teddy are bunkmates these days. Someone told me her husband's in prison for embezzlement. Do you know where he's incarcerated? Lompoc. It's been rough on her. I'd say she was homeless, but that's only because she's become a serial house sitter to avoid paying rent. She's hanging in with him, but who knows why. The guy's scum. The company he worked for went belly up after the news came out. He's probably the one who put Teddy together with Satterfield, because how else would she hear about a bum like him? What'd she want with that low-life kid, anyway? I thought that's why we were putting our heads together, to see if we could figure it out. She could be getting back at me for my little misstep with Stella. Sounds like the age difference is about the same. I don't think there's anything romantic going on. At the Rodeo Wilshire, the three of them were in separate rooms. Next morning, she took him to a stylist and then bought him a new wardrobe. Boy toy, he said. He powered down the treadmill and stepped off the track. Flip that if you would, he said, indicating the glowing power switch on the front of the machine. I bent and flipped it to the off position. He said, she's come back to the house a couple of times, acting like she still owns the place. I told the staff to keep a close eye on her and escort her to the door as soon as possible. So far, I don't think she's walked away with anything, but I got tired of fending her off. I finally changed the locks and alarm codes and then beefed up the rest of my security. Can't your attorney step in and put a stop to it? Who can afford to complain? I get billed the minute he picks up the phone. I don't understand why you're still at each other's throats. I thought divorce was supposed to cure that. That's what Stella says. I tell her, hey, it's not me, it's her. He stood and toweled off the sweat. Thing about Teddy is, she's smart. There are people who are smart and people who just think they're smart. She's the real deal. She came up from nothing, same way I did. I'm not a sophisticated guy. Neither of us has a college degree, but Teddy's got a head on her, and she studies up. Anything she doesn't know, she learns. He went on with his commentary, which was largely critical, but underscored by a grudging admiration. As he detailed her many faults, grasping, insatiable, and spoiling for a fight, the unconscious smile that played across his face spoke more of veneration than distaste. What kicked off this latest round? I asked. I've been wondering about that myself, and here's what I think it was. She calls me a couple of weeks ago and starts kissing up. Says, water under the bridge, bygones be bygones, and I'm like, what? No hard feelings? Are you kidding me? Never in a million years. I said, uh-huh, to show I was listening. She says she's been thinking about the condominium because she netted a big chunk of change, and she knows I got the short end of the stick. She feels bad about it, she says. So then she says, if I want to work out a side deal, she'd be willing to discuss it. What kind of side deal? You said all you ended up with was used furniture. My question exactly. So I asked her outright. I said, what's so interesting about the shit that was in the condo? Most of that stuff's been sitting in the basement for years. There must be something of real value. Agreed.
Don't ask me what, because we never did a formal inventory. Stuff's been appraised, but I don't know what's what. The previous owners came over here from England just before the turn of the century. I don't know how the guy made his money, but there was plenty of it. The house was passed down I don't know how many times. The day the last family member died, the attorney locked the doors and left it just like it was. We bought it fully equipped and decked out, right down to the oriental rugs. Anyway, Teddy backed away from the subject, which doesn't mean she's giving up. If I know her, she'll just come at it from a different direction. Any chance she's sincere about making amends? He laughed. Nice idea, but no. Reason I thought the two of us should talk is that whole Beverly Hills scene between her and the ex-con. Nash lays it out for me, and it makes no sense. I figured he must have missed a beat, which is why I wanted to hear it from you. I said, why don't you just leave well enough alone? Are you hoping for a fight? Hey, not me. That's Teddy's M.O. We finally hammered out an agreement. Everything's divided up right down to the penny. I get this, she gets that. Sign on the dotted line, and we have a deal. She signs, I sign. Now she wants something else. What the hell is that about? Did you ever stop to think this is a conditioned response on your part? I said. You're so accustomed to Teddy besting you, you can't accept peace when she offers it. You want a drink? Iced tea? Sure. Wait here. He moved to the doorway where I could see an intercom mounted on the wall. He pressed a button. Yes, sir. Tell Maury to bring us a couple iced teas, and not that mint shit. Yes, sir. I'll be right back, he said. He paused to pull off his running shoes and padded into the next room in his sock feet. A moment later, I heard a shower running. 3 minutes later, he was back wearing fresh clothes and running a pocket comb through his hair. We went out onto the patio and sat down. Maury, who'd met me at the door, made her way down from the main house, bearing a silver tray on which she'd set two tall glasses of iced tea. When she reached us, she placed the tray on the wrought iron table between our two chairs. She'd included a silver creamer, a sugar bowl, and real linen cocktail napkins monogrammed with an X. While we sipped our tea, we sat and looked out at the property. The gardener's leaf blower punctuated the otherwise still air. I said, how do you keep the lawn so green? I have water trucked in. Ah. I thought he had finished bad-mouthing Teddy, but he'd clearly been brooding that I hadn't been brought around to his point of view. He took up his list of grievances as though I gave a shit. Okay, here. I should have told you this. Typical. She gets the sterling silver flatware, 639 pieces that price out at $398,500. She sold it to an antique dealer in New Orleans and got top dollar. I know because the dealer called me to make sure it was on the up and up. Are you following? I was following, but I didn't think he was going anywhere. This recital constituted a peculiar form of bragging. He was elevating himself by enumerating the dollar amounts of everything he'd lost to her. It sounds like she's stockpiling cash, I said. Why would she do that? You still have earning power. She doesn't, unless she has a skill set you haven't mentioned yet, I said. Who got the house? He seemed surprised. This house? I did, because she couldn't afford the property taxes or the upkeep. It has to be worth millions. 12. But that's down from what it was. Market's flat. What else did you get? Well, you know, half the stocks and bonds. I did get a Tiffany necklace she'd kill for. It was an anniversary gift, our 10th, but the judge put it in my column to offset the art she was claiming on her side. She put up a fuss like the jewelry had sentimental value, but that was strictly a negotiating tool. What's it worth? I could tell I was adapting to his view of the world. Every subject mentioned had a dollar sign attached. The necklace? Ooh, a bundle. These are diamonds and emerald-cut aquamarines. 190 carats total. total. Value on that beauty is $450,000. And she's crying, poor me, because I got it and she didn't. Where do you keep something like that? I got the perfect place. I'll show you in a bit. Maury caught Teddy in my study week before last, so she probably figured I had it in the wall safe. She's ballsy. She'll try anything. I wasn't interested in contributing to the Teddy trashing, but I thought if I signaled agreement with him, it might put an end to it. She's devious, I'll give you that. She sure succeeded in faking you out. And why is that? Because otherwise, it's no fun. Teddy's not happy unless she's putting one over on you. With her, everything's a shell game. You see my problem here? I do. And it's a tough one. I'm seriously thinking about canceling the honeymoon. I can't take the chance that I'll be off somewhere. Minute my back is turned, she'll get in high gear. I come back, half the stuff will be gone. When do you leave? Friday, providing I don't scratch the trip. I'd lose 25 grand in deposits, which I'm willing to eat. Stella's pissed I'd even consider pulling the plug. I haven't done it yet, but I'm this close. Maybe that's Teddy's hope, to mess up your travel plans. He looked at me. You think that's it? I'm just throwing out possibilities, I said. I felt a twinge of guilt because he'd brightened at the notion when I tossed it out off the top of my head. I got a great idea. Here's something just occurred to me. Why don't you tail the woman for 2 days and see what she does? It might be very educational. No, thanks. I'm serious. I don't have the savvy or the wherewithal. Nash tells me you're a whiz. I don't do domestic. No good ever comes of it. How much do you charge? I'm talking about your hourly rate. What difference does it make? I'm not for hire. Pay you $100 an hour. No. 200. No. Okay, 250, but that's as high as I go. I laughed. Listen, Ari, as much as I admire your bargaining skills, I'm really not interested. Here's another idea. Off point, but I could have the kid picked up. That would put a crimp in her plan, don't you think? If the police arrest the guy? For doing what? Parole violation. He's a convicted felon, so drugs or alcohol. Possession of firearms. Rat him out to his parole officer. You have him arrested, and she'll just go out and find another ex-con. Maybe so, maybe not. He's a good-looking dude, right? That is true, I said. Which brings us back to the boy toy idea. She's trying to get my goat. Retaliate for Stella. Why would she pick an ex-con? You think there aren't dozens of good-looking guys out there cruising for patronage? Ex-con's easier to control. Come on. Why don't you help me out? You follow her for 2 days and put an end to the debate. No thanks. Don't say no right off the bat, he said irritably. Think about it. Ari insisted on giving me a tour of his security system, which did seem to be state-of-the-art. In the endless stretches of basement, there was a room dedicated to closed-circuit television sets, where banks of monitors showed a succession of pictures from cameras that covered views of each room, shots of the corridors, shots of the entrances and exits, and wide-angle shots that covered the exterior. While I looked on, the views flipped like a slideshow, first one room and then the next. It was hard to focus on all the screens as they rotated through. You have someone who actually sits and monitors these? I just hired a guy. A couple of blind spots in there, but good otherwise. Impressive, I said. Glad you think so. Come take a look at this. I followed him through the gloom to a side room about the size of a broom closet. He flipped on the overhead light, and a 40-watt bulb illuminated a massive, round, brass and steel safe that resembled an oversized antique diver's helmet on a chunky base. The faceplate was jeweled, and the combination lock sat in the center of the round door. A large hand crank was affixed to the front, and the hinges were hefty. called a Diebold cannonball safe. 3,600 pounds. 3 time locks you can set so the mechanism can't be opened for as much as 72 hours. It was the latest technology of its time. Which was when? Late 1800s. It was in the house when we bought it. Is it in working order? Oh, sure. I had to have a guy come in and open it the first time. I had this fantasy of gold pieces. It was empty. Just my tough luck, but it's come in handy since. That's where you keep the necklace? Better here than that dinky wall safe upstairs. Besides, Teddy knows the combination to that one, not this. You didn't change the combination to the safe upstairs? What good would it do? She knows how my mind works. She could probably figure this one out now that I think about it. He flicked off the light and led the way out of the basement. I'd have thought the shadowy chambers would be spooky, but the whole of it was tidy and dry, with nary a spider in sight. We took the elevator up. Walking back through the hallway, I could see that additional pieces of furniture had been brought up, some swaddled in sheets. Worker bees were still on the scene. A 2-man team wrapped and packed blue and white glazed ceramic pieces, part of a collection of Chinese porcelains. There was no sign of Stella. I made my exit, exhausted by the entire encounter. In spite of myself, I liked the guy. He was a bit of a blowhard, but he had a sweetness about him. I wondered if Stella had any idea what she was up against. Ari wasn't complicated. He was still in love with his wife. While I'd continued to decline his offer of paid work, I did consider his proposal for 30 seconds on my way home. I had said no, in part, because sometime soon I'd need to have a talk with Christian Satterfield, and I didn't want to do so with Ari's employment offer hanging over my head. One thing I've learned about money: the guy who pays has the power. Saying no kept our relationship equitable and on an even keel. Chapter 34. On my way to Taryn's office, I stopped off at a delicatessen where I bought 1 tuna salad sandwich on rye and 1 egg salad on whole wheat, plus Fritos and the Pepperidge Farm Milanos on which my mental health is so often dependent. I hadn't mentioned dinner in our phone conversation, but I was hungry, and I took a chance she'd be hungry as well. If she already had dinner plans, I'd take the leftovers home with me. I parked in the lot behind her building. I'd barely settled on the love seat when she came out to the waiting room. "Your timing's great. Turns out my last client canceled, so I managed to get caught up. Come on in." She wore tight jeans with a pair of spike heels and a dark red blazer that was open as far as the first button, her cleavage modestly veiled by a lacy white camisole. She wore the same big hoop earrings and the messy hairdo that somehow looked chic. Her lipstick was bright red, and it looked like it wouldn't come off on the lip of her coffee cup the first time she took a sip. I report this in detail because she's the sort of woman I want to be when I grow up. No chance of it at this late date. But all the same, I held up the paper bag. "Dinner. I hope you don't mind." "Perfect. I should have thought of it myself." I unloaded my purchases and arranged the deli items on the coffee table. We traded sandwiches, so we each had half a tuna salad and half an egg salad. She kept cans of Diet Pepsi in a mini-fridge, and she popped the tops on 2. She kicked off her heels and propped her feet on the coffee table. She wore pantyhose, and the nylon soles were pristine. I sat on the floor with my back against one of the 2 upholstered chairs. We both salted the shit out of the egg salad, and then munched happily, engaged in small talk. She finally crumpled the empty paper wrappers and made an accurate overhand shot to the wastebasket before she turned back to me. "So, what's up, Buttercup?" "I need a reality check, and I don't know who else to talk to. I'd like to run a few things by you and make sure I'm on the right track." If this is about Ned Lowe, I am completely unbiased except for the fact that I hate the guy and hope he falls in a hole and dies. Fine with me. I can't wait to hear this. Saturday, I drove to Burning Oaks and talked to a couple of people who knew Lenore. One was a former neighbor and one was her parish priest. Disconcerted, she said, "You drove to Burning Oaks? What possessed you?" "Your fault," I said. "Between you and Pete's widow, I was shamed into taking up his cause. You remember the mailer?" "Sure. Pete hid it in the bottom of a banker's box." "Right," I said. "The keepsakes were meant for April. I'm not sure why he didn't deliver them himself. He went to Burning Oaks a year ago, and the priest gave it to him, which is how the mailer ended up in his hands. I wanted to be clear what I was getting into before I delivered it." I filled her in on my conversation with Clara Doyle and Father Xavier, and then moved on to the research I'd done with regard to Ned, Lenore, and Shirley Ann Castle. I talked to a high school classmate who knew all three, and she told me a convoluted story I won't go into here. Bottom line was that Ned Lowe was obsessed with Shirley Ann, who dated him for a while and then broke up with him when she and her former boyfriend got back together. Ned stalked her for weeks. Things got so bad her mother sent her back east to finish high school. Fast forward 5 years. Shirley Ann's mother was terminally ill, and Shirley Ann came back to Burning Oaks to take care of her. Ned attached himself to her as though they'd never been separated. He was married to Lenore by then. Shirley Ann was also married, and she told Ned a relationship between them was impossible because of it. I'm wondering if Ned helped Lenore along, thinking he could at least rid himself of that impediment. "Oh, man, I don't like the sound of that at all," she said. "Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt. You've got the mailer. You're back in town, and now you know your mission." "Right. I didn't think I should show up at April's unannounced, so I called her on Monday. She completely misunderstood what I was getting at and jumped to the conclusion I was hustling her. She called her dad, and he turned around and called the county sheriff. I ended up in a verbal standoff with Ned and a deputy. Nothing came of it, but it was obnoxious, and I was pissed." "Shit." "Under the circumstances, I didn't think it was smart to hand her the mailer just then. Then lo and behold, she showed up at my office yesterday, and I passed it on to her." "What was in it?" "Lenore's Bible, her rosary, a couple of keepsakes, and a photo of Ned, not quite four, sitting on his mother's lap." "Ooh, that's bad. She abandoned him when he was four." "Which is what I want to talk about. You think that's where all this craziness comes from? Because that's what I'm picking up on. You want the long answer or the short?" "Long, by all means." "There's a subclass of kids like him. I think of them as junior psychopaths. They're disconnected and cold and lack any semblance of humanity. Symptoms typically manifest in adolescence, which is when you start seeing aggression and antisocial acting out. It can also show up in kids as young as three, and that's a tougher proposition. Sometimes these kids are ADHD and sometimes not, but they're always unemotional. They might have tantrums, but what looks like fury is pure manipulation. They have no empathy and they have no desire to please. They don't care about punishment. They don't care about other people's pain and suffering. It just doesn't interest them." "You think he's one of them?" "No question. I started following the research, or what there was of it, when I first realized what a sick puppy he is. The studies I've seen suggest low levels of cortisol, which affects our ability to feel fear. Without fear, they have no concept of consequences." "Does this run in families?" "The jury's still out on that one, but I'll tell you what he told me. Frankie was cold and rejecting, and she punished him for every little thing he did, If he cried or wet his pants or he spilled his milk or made noise. She burned him. She locked him out of the house. She tried to drown him in the bathtub when he was 3. She'd whip him with a stick until the backs of his legs were bloody. He tried so hard to be good, but she left him anyway.
I don't want to feel sorry for him, I said irritably.
I'm not saying it was cause and effect. It's one small part of the whole. Growing up, he managed to acquire a thin candy shell of charm, and that's served him well. It doesn't address the underlying pathology, but it allows him to pass as one of us. Those are the kids who turn into criminals, right? Some do, but it's almost a side effect. I'll give you the perfect example. When I was still in school, I worked at one of the state hospitals for 6 months. This was the only time I actually encountered one of these ducks. I was doing a psychiatric workup on this kid, evaluating his suitability for placement in a group home. He'd come to us by way of juvenile court because he'd pushed his little sister out a second-story window. She was 2, and she survived, but that didn't seem to interest him in the least. When I asked him about the incident, his attitude was clinical. She was pestering him, and he was curious what would happen if he tossed her out. He had no guilt or shame about what he'd done, so it didn't occur to him to be secretive. Ned's smarter than that, but I suspect his mindset's much the same. What's he do for a living? You told me once, but you'll have to tell me again. He's in outside sales. At least he was when I dated him. Probably still doing it in one form or another. He can be warm and thoughtful and empathetic. I was completely taken in when we first met. I thought we were soulmates. It doesn't last, but it's irresistible when he's rolling out the charm. His job is to get along with people, chin wag and problem solve and make nice, which might seem odd until you realize it's all learned behavior. He's human by imitation. Maybe that's why he does such a good job of it. There's no unruly emotion to get in the way of his goal, which is to dominate. What was the company? Van Schaik Chemicals. They manufacture polymers and engineering plastics, also agricultural products. We were a small branch, and most of what we handled was related to crop protection. I was in the marketing department. How'd you end up doing that? Oh, who knows? It's not like I grew up drooling over color brochures for cutworms and fungicides. What about Ned? He started as a crop production services advisor and ended up Southwest Regional Manager. He was an ag major at Cal Poly with an emphasis on business, so he has solid management abilities. He's great with clients, not so great when it comes to dealing with other employees, especially women. Underneath, he's not like the rest of us. It's probably stupid to say this, but this guy's genuinely dangerous, isn't he? More so if he starts unraveling. You can call him a psychopath or a sociopath, but what's curious in his case is that he doesn't display the irresponsibility or the chronic instability that are characteristic. To me, this makes him all the more dangerous, to use your word, because he comes so close to mimicking normal. So far, his thinking's been organized. What would make him truly dangerous is losing his ability to maintain a front. Back up a step. If he played a part in Lenore's death, he must have felt some guilt, or he wouldn't have covered up. That was early in the game. I can't believe we're doing this. We're talking about him like he's a stone-cold killer. Based on what? I'd say intuition, but that's not worth much. I'll tell you one thing about guys like him, and I'm just going by what I've read. They hang on to trophies, nothing big, just little things. Totem objects? Something like that. He'd keep trinkets, even if he's the only one who knows what they mean. Because he's hoping to get caught? She shook her head. because he wants to remind himself of all the good times he had.
This is not filling me with confidence.
Which is a good thing, she said.
Just morbidly curious here.
Did he use that choking trick on you? His ex tells me he learned it in high school and used it during sex.
I gather the effects are spectacular if you don't mind being on the brink of death.
She laughed. Maybe that's what Shirley Ann objected to.
Thankfully, I was spared.
Well, somehow he managed to perfect his skills.
You'd think it would take practice.
Bet you can put an ad in the personals and find like-minded playmates, she said. What's your current feeling about April? Will you tell her what you suspect about her dad?
What would you do with the information?
The guy may be certifiable, but I have no proof.
It's possible she knows he's bent, and she's been averting her eyes.
I would, I said. Who wants to admit a parent is the boogeyman?
That's what adults are supposed to protect us from. What happens if your father turns out to be the horror you thought was hiding under your bed?
That's what keeps me in business, she said. When I got to work the next morning, I turned once again to the issues Pete had dropped in my lap. Susan Telford was the only one whose story I hadn't heard. I tried directory assistance in Henderson, Nevada, asking for phone numbers for the last name Telford, and was rewarded with the sorry news that there were 33. I asked for the first 10. I was already tired of the job, and I hadn't even started yet. There had to be an easier way to go about this. I considered my alternatives. Wait a minute. Let's be honest. This was me being cagey, pretending an idea just occurred to me when it was pretty much on my mind 24/7. I never hear the word Nevada without thinking of Robert Dietz. This coming May, we'd celebrate our 6th anniversary of hardly ever seeing each other. Truly, in the time I'd known him, I'm not sure we'd ever been together more than 2 months at a stretch, and that was only once. Naturally, we get along beautifully in between my being completely pissed off with him because he's left me again. Before I could change my mind, I dialed his number in Carson City. 3 rings, and his machine picked up. I listened to his outgoing message, which was terse and to the point. I waited for the beep and said, "Hey, Dietz, this is Kinsey. I need a favor from you. I'm looking for a woman named Susan Telford in Henderson, Nevada, and I wondered if you'd see what you could find out. There are 33 Telfords listed, and it doesn't make sense for me to tackle the job from here. Pete Walensky put her name on a list of 6 women who were all connected in one way or another to a man named Ned Lowe. Pete went to some lengths to do background on Lowe, who seems like an all-around bad egg. If you have questions, call me back. And if you don't want to do the job at all, that's fine. Just let me know." Since my typewriter was still set up on the desk, I decided it was time to convert my investigation into report form. I had accumulated any number of facts. Granted, none were earth-shattering, but who knew what they might add up to? Working for purely personal reasons didn't absolve me of the need to be thorough. I was formulating a sense of the relationship between Ned Lowe and the 6 women whose names appeared on Pete's list. But so far, the link existed only in my head. To be useful, there had to be an overarching narrative account that would make the information comprehensible to someone unfamiliar with the circumstances. For my purposes, I found it helpful to maintain a running resume of what I'd done, not only with an eye to discovering gaps, but in hopes of highlighting other avenues of inquiry. I had my doubts about whether my efforts would pay off, but documentation is never a bad idea. I kept the language neutral, and in the process forced myself to separate my opinions from the specifics of what I'd learned. My beliefs about Ned Lowe had to be deleted, even if it grieved me to do so. What I was defining in narrative form were the dots that I hoped to connect when all the bits and pieces were in place. The phone rang and I picked up the handset, tucking it between my shoulder and my ear while I rolled the paper out of the carriage and placed it on my desk. Milhone Investigations. A gentleman with a powdery voice said, "Miss Milhone? This is Stanley Muntz, formerly with the Burning Oaks Police Department. An acquaintance by the name of Clara Doyle told me you'd spoken to her about a case here some years ago. Is that correct?"
"Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for calling. I was asking about Lenore Redfern Lowe." "That was my understanding. I'm afraid I don't have much to offer on the subject, but I will tell you what I can. I was the coroner's investigator at the time of the young girl's death. In order to complete a death certificate, the coroner has to determine the cause, mechanism, and manner of death. If you're familiar with the distinctions, I won't go into it."
"No, please do," I said. "I can always use a refresher course."
"Simply put, cause of death is the reason the individual died, as would be the case with a heart attack or a gunshot wound. The mechanism of death would be the actual changes that affect the victim's physiology, resulting in death. Death from a fatal stabbing, for instance, might be extreme blood loss. The manner of death is how the death came about. Five of the six possibilities there are natural, accidental, suicide, homicide, and undetermined. The sixth classification would be pending if the matter's still under investigation, which is obviously not the case here. There was no question about her ingestion of Valium and alcohol. The generic diazepam is a central nervous system depressant, the effects of which can be intensified by alcohol. The problem arose because when the toxicology report came in, it appeared there wasn't a sufficient quantity of either to say with any certainty death resulted from the combination of the two. What seemed questionable, at least in my mind, was the presence of petechiae, which are tiny broken blood vessels like pinpricks visible in the area of her eyes. Hard coughing or crying are common causes. Sometimes even the strain of childbirth or lifting weights. Petechiae can also be a sign of death by asphyxiation."
"You mean she might have been suffocated?"
"Smothered, yes. There were no fractures of the larynx, hyoid bone, thyroid, or cricoid cartilages, and no areas of bruising, which ruled out manual strangulation. Mrs. Lowe had been under doctor's care. With her history of mental problems, absent any other compelling evidence, Dr. Wilkinson felt a finding of suicide was appropriate. I put up what objections I could, but I have no formal medical training, and his experience and expertise prevailed. For my part, I was never fully persuaded."
"So there was never an investigation into the circumstances of her death?"
"A cursory assessment, I'd say. Dr. Wilkinson was of the old school, high-handed and a bit of an autocrat. He was in charge. He made the judgment call, and he brooked no argument. I was putting my job at risk even to raise the few questions I did."
"It sounds like your options were limited."
"One could say that." After a moment's hesitation, he went on, "Are you familiar with the term birking?"
"Birking? I don't think so."
"Nor was I until I ran across a series of murders that occurred in Edinburgh, Scotland, back in the 1800s. I'm a history buff, especially where medical matters are concerned. I was in the midst of combing through old newspapers when I chanced on the case of William Burke and William Hare, who killed some 16 unlucky souls in order to supply cadavers to an anatomist named Dr. Robert Knox. Burke's method was what caught my attention. He and Hare would focus on intoxicated individuals and then suffocate them by covering their mouths and pinching their noses closed. The technique left little to no evidence of foul play."
"Mr. Muntz, I can't believe you're telling me this. I just had a phone conversation with Ned Lowe's second wife, and she talked about a choking maneuver he used during sex."
"Ah, that would be known as asphyxiophilia when it's incorporated into sex with a partner. He must have been proficient at it. I could feel myself blink as I struggled to assimilate the information. Why haven't I ever heard of Birking? You'll find references once you start looking for them. I didn't become aware of the case until many years after Lenore's death, or I'd have raised the issue myself. What happened to the pair? Hare was granted immunity from prosecution and testified against Burke, who was convicted and hanged on January 28, 1829. A short time later, Hare disappeared. To my knowledge, he was never heard of again. There were the usual rumors, of course, but no sign of the man himself. Unbelievable, I said. But true, nonetheless. I wish I could offer you more. It's bothered me for years, but yours is the first question ever raised about that girl. Which was not quite the case. There had been another question raised in the matter, and that was Pete's. I thanked him for the information, and he graciously suggested that if I had additional questions, I should feel free to call. He gave me his number in Burning Oaks. Chapter 35. After I hung up, I sat for a moment, trying to understand what effect his considered opinion might have. Munce's views reinforced my suspicion that Ned Lowe hastened Lenore's death without providing tangible support. I believed I was on the right track, but what good is belief without corroborating evidence? I still hadn't met Ned's current wife, so maybe it was time I talked to Celeste. I couldn't understand how any woman would be attracted to him. But people tell me I'm way too picky, so perhaps I'm the wrong one to ask. Not that anyone had asked me. I sorted through my notes until I found April's home number and put in a call. When she picked up the line on her end, I said, "This is Kinsey Milhone. I was wondering if you could give me a phone number for Celeste." "I can't believe you're calling me. I was just about to pick up the phone and call you." "A happy coincidence. What's going on?" "I did something dumb, and I thought I'd better let you know. Promise you won't get mad."
"Why don't you just say what you did before you ask for a guarantee?"
"Dad and Celeste came up for dinner last night."
"Okay.
You remember the framed photograph of my grandmother with my father sitting on her lap?"
"How could I forget? I just gave it to you."
"I know. I really love that picture, and I was so happy to have a link to the past."
"That you did what?"
"I set it on the bookshelf in our bedroom. You can't even see it from the door, so I didn't think there was any way Dad would spot it. He never goes into that part of the house. I can't imagine what possessed him."
"He knew I wanted to deliver something, so he was probably on the alert for anything new or different."
"That's the only explanation I can think of, because I swear I never said a word about our conversation. I just feel so bad about this."
"Go on."
"At one point, while we were eating dinner, he excused himself and went off to the bathroom. That's the only time he left the table. Usually he uses the powder room in the hall. But for some reason, he must have chosen the bathroom off the master bedroom. When he came back, I noticed he was withdrawn. I asked what was wrong, but he waved it aside. He and Celeste left earlier than usual, but I didn't think anything of it. I didn't realize there was a problem until she called this morning. She said he was livid about the photograph. I guess the two of them got into a terrible fight on the way home. She said I should be able to display a picture of my own grandmother anywhere I wanted, and he was making a big fuss over nothing."
"That doesn't sound like a bright move."
"I thought you said she was such a mouse.
Surely she's aware he's touchy on the subject of his mother."
"I know, but she'd had a couple of drinks, and I guess it just came out.
Now she says he's furious with both of us and in a rage at you because he blames you for everything."
"She had drinks? I thought you said she was in AA." "She didn't have them here. She belted down a couple before they left home. I didn't see any sign of inebriation, but he says she's the master at hiding it."
"When did you talk to him?"
"He called right before she did.
He says she's blown the whole thing out of proportion. He admitted he was unhappy about the photograph, but now he's fine with it. He says she's the one who's going off the deep end, and he's seriously concerned.
He thinks she's cracking up?
Well, yes. I mean, he said he didn't want me to worry, but of course I do, which is why I'm calling. I know it's an imposition, but is there any way you could stop by the house and make sure she's okay? As Dad points out, if she's drinking again, we could end up with a mess on our hands. I don't mean to sound cranky, but why don't you do that? She's your stepmother. They live in Cottonwood, which is closer to you than it is to me. I have a doctor's appointment in 40 minutes, so I don't have time to get down there and back. All you have to do is reassure her he's cooled down. He said he talked to her this morning till he was blue in the face. He thinks she's close to a nervous breakdown. What if I knock and he comes to the door? He's already in a rage. He's not home. He called me from work. He has meetings this morning, and he won't be free until noon. He's making his annual photographic retreat, and he leaves town first thing in the morning. He's taking the afternoon off work to get everything done. I wouldn't press you to go down there, but he reminded me in the past she's talked about, you know, doing away with herself.
I could feel a tickle on the back of my neck, a spider of fear crawling along my collar. Give me the address and phone number.
The drive to Cottonwood took less than 15 minutes. I wasn't sure what Celeste would make of my appearance on her doorstep. Her fight with Ned was obviously none of my business, but if she didn't want to talk to me, she could simply say so. I cruised the neighborhood, searching for the house number, which fell in the middle of the block. I parked on the nearest side street and walked back. Celeste and Ned Lowe lived in what was probably a 1,600-square-foot, one-story board-and-batten house, painted a soft gray, with a shake roof, solar panels, and a living room with a bay window. I was guessing 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, and a kitchen in desperate need of rehabilitation. There was no sign of Ned's black sedan in the driveway. The garage doors were closed, and I had no way of knowing if his car and hers were tucked away inside. I'd have to take April's word for his being tied up at work. I rang the bell, staring out of the driveway while I waited. There was an older model aluminum and galvanized steel Argosy motor home parked in the side yard, white with a brown stripe that ran around its middle. The back end of the vehicle was rounded, and a unit affixed to the top suggested a working air conditioner. The license plate read Photo Biz, which I assumed referred to Ned's photography. Decals from countless tourist stops had been applied in a tidy line along the brown painted stripe. This was a history of Ned's travels, spelled out one town at a time in a series of slogans. Falloway, Texas, happiest little city in the West. Paradise, Arizona, ghost town of Cochise County. Prairie, Nevada, host of the 1985 Wild West Rodeo. The door was opened, and Celeste stared out at me, fair-haired and pale. Celeste?
Yes?
I'm Kinsey. I'm a friend of April's. She asked me to stop by and make sure you're okay.
I'm fine. May I come in?
She didn't look me in the eye, and she didn't reply, but she didn't close the door in my face, which I took as a good sign. She considered my request, and then stepped back. I entered the house and followed her into the living room, noting that she sat in a chair that allowed her to keep an eye on the street through the picture window in the front. She was tense and thin, in the manner of someone with an eating disorder. Her dark eyes were at odds with her fair coloring, and seemed enormous in the delicate oval of her face. Are you expecting Ned? April told me he's tied up in meetings until noon.
I wouldn't count on it. He says things like that all the time and then pops in unexpectedly, hoping to catch me unawares. He likes to keep me on my toes.
On the wall behind her, there were 2 enlarged black-and-white photographs that I assumed were Ned's.
Over the fireplace there were two more in stark black frames. He was apparently fascinated with rock formations, limestone worn down by chemical weathering, sedimentary layers undulating along a ridge, granite outcroppings, a massive sandstone bed that had eroded into a single towering crag. Striking, but cold.
Are those his?
She nodded. He hopes to retire from his sales job and make a living from his photography. That's part of what he does on his annual treks. He goes to galleries to show his portfolio.
Her tone of voice had the flat quality of someone reading from a script. She seemed to wear her passivity like a Kevlar vest. Getting through to her would be impossible unless I could find a way to gain her trust.
Do his prints sell? Her smile was brief. Lately, they have. April says he's leaving tomorrow. Unless he cancels or delays or changes his mind.
Where's he going this time?
He says I don't need to know. If I press him for information, he says I'm trying to control his every move.
When, in fact, that's what he's doing to you, I said.
She gave one of those little half-shrugs. Are you okay? You seem to be operating in a fog. Ned says I'm depressed.
Do you have an opinion of your own?
That's what the drinking was about. I've been depressed all my life, and that's how I made myself feel better.
But you're not drinking now.
I've been clean and sober for 4.5 years.
That's great.
I'm not sure I could do that myself, I said. I understand the two of you got into a disagreement last night. My fault. I should have kept my mouth shut. When I called April this morning, I was upset. I'm better now.
Are you aware that he called her just before you did?
Oh. She didn't say anything about that.
He told her you were drinking again, which is one of the reasons she was so concerned.
He tells people at work the same thing. I know, because one of his co-workers called me and offered to help. He told her I was flipping out.
This doesn't sound like a wonderful way to live.
I'm used to it, I guess, she said. Why are you so concerned?
I was a friend of Pete Walensky's. He contacted you a year ago, didn't he?
She nodded. He was concerned about my safety. He believed Ned was dangerous and I needed some way to protect myself. Leverage, he called it.
What's wrong with running for your life?
Where would I go?
There are shelters for women who need help.
Ned knows where they are. He has friends in law enforcement. He can get any address he wants.
That's bullshit. He's feeding you a load of crap.
I don't think so. The one time I left, he killed his own dog, took him out in the backyard and shot him in the head. He said it broke his heart, but he wanted me to understand how serious he was about our relationship. No one leaves him.
Did Pete have an idea about how to get you out of here?
He put me in touch with Ned's second wife.
The answer was so unexpected, I squinted. Phyllis?
I met her for coffee. He said it would be good for me to talk to a woman who was sure of herself and strong, one who'd gotten away from him.
That sounds like Phyllis, I said. I haven't met her, but I talked to her on the phone.
She was great. She could tell I was scared to death of Ned, and she tried to set me straight. She says everyone's vulnerable somewhere, and she thinks photography is Ned's Achilles heel. She's an accountant, and when they were married, she was on him all the time about keeping better records. She told him if he could show a profit from his photography, he could deduct ordinary and necessary expenses. He'd have to hang on to his receipts, but how hard is that? He didn't like the idea. Most of the time he's paid under the table, and he doesn't want to declare the income. He says as long as he keeps his mouth shut, the government won't find out.
A lot of people feel the same way until they're caught.
She said if he's falsifying his tax returns, I can put in a call to the IRS and let the feds take care of him.
No offense, Celeste.
But if he's willing to kill his own dog, Ned's not worried about the IRS. That was Pete's response as well, but he thought it was a starting place. Ned's secretive. I'm not supposed to touch anything of his. In particular, I'm not allowed in his dark room. He keeps it locked, and he's warned me 100 times I'm not to go in there.
Please tell me you had the gumption to disobey the man.
Her smile wasn't expansive, but it was the first time I'd seen the real Celeste peek out of her eyes.
I did. Pete pushed me to do it.
Ned's job keeps him on the road part of every month. The next time he went off on a business trip, I searched the house. I found a key in an old floor register under the wall-to-wall carpet in the hall. Once I knew where he'd hidden it, I could let myself in any time I wanted.
Good for you, I said.
Not really, but Pete thought I was doing great.
And Ned didn't catch on.
It didn't seem to occur to him. It was the first time I realized he wasn't all-seeing and all-powerful. Next chance I had, I went into the dark room. That was disappointing. Most of what he has in there is standard photographic supplies, cameras, film, chemicals, developing tanks, things like that. File after file of photographs, proof sheets, negatives. One file cabinet he kept locked, but by then I understood how his mind worked. He'd hidden that key and a smaller one in a film canister on the shelf above the sink in there. In the bottom drawer, there was a locked metal box that the smaller key fit. Inside, there were receipts and some other stuff.
Receipts for what?
Motels, restaurants, gasoline.
You think he decided to play by the rules?
Maybe he's beginning to think of photography as a real business instead of something he does on the side. He says he may be making a big change.
What do you think that means?
I don't know. And I wouldn't ask.
What else was in the box? You mentioned other stuff.
She shrugged. I don't know. Ticket stubs, a couple of parking passes for the wilderness areas he visits. He likes camping in the backcountry, which is where he does some of his photo shoots.
What did you do with the box?
I took everything out and put it in an envelope for Pete, and then locked the box in the drawer. Pete said he'd do an inventory, so we'd know what we had. What happened, though, was someone offered him a job that he felt he had to take.